Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 296, I chat with audio experts Bob Schuline and Dan Mapes Riordan about some new high-res audio tests they've come up with. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded March 17th, 2016. Episode 296, New High-Res Audio Tests. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/HTG. And by Drobo, a family of safe and expandable yet simple-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit Drobo.com/TWiT and use the code TWIT100 to save $100 off a Drobo Mini, Drobo 4-Bay, or Drobo 5N. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week, I have two guest geeks on the show. One, a returning guest, Bob Schuline, longtime AV audio industry consultant and co-founder of Immersive. Hey, Bob, welcome back.
Nice to see you, Scott. Always a pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you, and always a pleasure to have you here with us. Also with joining us is Dan Mapes Riordan, another founding member of, founding partner, I should say, of Immersive, and also an expert in psychoacoustics, which is a subject near and dear to my heart as well. Hey, Dan, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Scott. It's a pleasure to be on your show. I watch it all the time, and now I get to see myself on the other side.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv can join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions for us as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It always helps if you use my screen name in the chat room, which is my name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes or spaces, because it shows up in a different color on my screen, and my eye is drawn to it more readily. So what we're going to talk about today is high-resolution audio, which has the potential, anyway, to offer a greater frequency range and dynamic range. Certainly it does offer that, than CDs. But the question is, can humans perceive that greater frequency response and dynamic range? And Bob and Dan have developed some new audio files to test this, and they're making them available to anyone who wants to try this for themselves, which I love. I'm going to be putting them on AVS Forum here in the next day or two, so you'll be able to get them from there. I'll tell you about that again later. But Bob, why don't you start us off with the motivation that you had for wanting to develop these files and do these kinds of tests?
Thanks, Scott. I think by way of a little history, the term high-resolution audio is one that has come into the vernacular probably within the last 10 years or so. But I think it's important to note that prior to the CD coming out, the technology used in studios was tape recording-based and really had the ability to record bandwidth and signal-to-noise ratio beyond human hearing. Noise reduction like Dolby SR and recording half-track and 30-inch per second and so forth could produce program material that was very wide band and had high dynamic range. But the consumer's access to this was primarily the phonograph record and for some magnetic tape and maybe cassette. Mm-hmm. Then along comes the CD, and a stake is put in the ground by the developers of the CD, in which they said, we're going to produce a format that has a 96 dB signal to noise ratio capability via 16-bit words and a bandwidth of approximately 20-some kilohertz using 44.1 sampling rate. Mm-hmm. So then time marches on, and it seems like once anything is developed, there's a natural tendency to want to make it better. So as the semiconductor business progressed, we found ways where we could all of a sudden do things with greater bit depth. 24-bit became a reality, and higher sampling rates, and DSD, all of these things related to giving you more and more of both bandwidth and frequency response. So,
and dynamic range.
And dynamic range, right. So the point is that the thing that really changed that caused people to use the word high res was a fixed res from the industry and then developing something that was better. And then the controversy and questions, et cetera, started. So our motivation was to try to get to the root of what people can hear, not in a way where we try to prove anything. There's always been this talk, and it's been discussed on your show before, can people tell the difference? And it's like you're looking for some ultimate test where people listen to this and that, and they say yes or no. And it stands to logic that everybody is different from the standpoint of the equipment they have, their hearing acuity. So you probably could never make such a blanket statement anyway. So the thought occurred to Dan and I that maybe we could offer a service to people by creating some tests that would allow an individual to answer the question, what are my dynamic range needs and what are my bandwidth needs? And that was the motivation. Mm-hmm. So what we're prepared to talk about today takes us along those two paths.
So these are sort of more tests for individuals to determine what are the limits of their hearing to find out really whether or not what high resolution audio, so-called, gives you is even perceptible to them, to one individual or another.
That's correct. It not only their hearing, but the environment they're in and the particular equipment that they have, because obviously the equipment needs to be able to store and play and reproduce the various sound files that are available today.
Mm-hmm. Dan, how did you become interested in this project?
Well, Bob and I have known each other for a long time, and it's something we, you know, being in the audio industry, you're always talking about how good can you make it, how, and as an engineer designing equipment, it's common to ask the question, if I make it better, will people be able to hear the difference? Or mm-hmm. sometimes you, when you're making a new product, maybe you're just trying to cut costs, for example. In that case, you're saying, well, what can I take away and still leave it to be sounding just as good? So it's a similar type of question. And so I've been working on these issues all my career. And it's interesting about these tests in particular is the other aspect of it. Since people are more or less self-administering and we're not telling results or anything like that, is one limiting factor they're finding that I think people are finding is that in the signal chain are their own ears, and they're finding that, well, wait, I have my speakers that can go to 40 kilohertz, but my ears are starting to fall off, starting at maybe 15 kilohertz or 12 kilohertz in some cases. And so that's another aspect of it, is just knowing how people can perceive sound. And what are some, we do know there's a natural fall off in how you can hear high frequencies with age. There's just a natural aging process of the ear, and such that we can all expect to lose our high frequency hearing as we age.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Emily the Strange in the chat room is bringing up that exact point. Wouldn't your perception change with time as you get older? Do these tests take into account the effect of aging?
Yes, that's correct. And go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, yes, they do, because you can use the test anytime you'd like. And you could take it today and you could take it in 5 years and track yourself, for example.
Mm-hmm. I've always advocated that anybody who's really depends on their hearing, musicians particularly, or audiophiles who really want to hear the most they can, should really go to an audiologist and get a hearing test. And we actually have a picture. I'm going to call these a little bit out of order, Josh, so pardon me for that. But in slide number 3, we have a picture of what you might expect when you go to the audiologist. Dan, why don't you tell us a little bit about this?
Sure. It's just a standard, what they're trying to create is your standard audiogram. As you can see, the graph on the right-hand side there. So you put on the headphones and there'll be a tone in one ear and you'll raise your hand to which ear you hear it, either be the left ear or the right ear. And through a sequence of playing tones to different ears at different levels, the audiologist is mapping when you can and cannot hear a particular sound. One particular thing to note in these audiology tests is that they're primarily focused on the hearing aid industry itself in general, you could say, is primarily focused on speech. And so you could notice that the frequencies that they were testing only went up to 8 kilohertz. And so they're really concentrating in the we'd call the mid-range bands for speech, as you can see that right there. It's going from 250 hertz to 8 kilohertz.
Right. And most audiologists, their audiometers, which is that device there that does this, only go up to 8K. But if you're a musician or someone interested in the entire bandwidth, it's possible to find an audiologist whose audiometer goes up higher. The one I go to here in L.A., Dr. Beverly Liu at Sound Advice, let me give her a plug, her audiometer goes up to 16K. So that gives you a fuller range of what you're seeing, or what you're hearing, I should say. But in that one audiogram that we saw there a moment ago, I just wanted to point out that whoever that was has a severe hearing loss in the upper mid range, in the upper range of what gets tested. As you see, if we can pull that back up, there it is, and focus in on the audiogram there on the right. It starts out pretty normal and then drops off dramatically up to, you know, I guess it's 6K or so.
That's correct. Everyone is different, and you can't tell from this particular case what caused that particular hearing loss. I'd seen examples like this from people who are maybe in, you know, 70, 80, 90 years old, and you're just going to get a natural fall off of the high frequencies. It doesn't look like it's also possible it could be occupational, but it's hard to say just from one graph.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. As a musician, as a trombone player sitting in front of the trumpets in a big band, I can tell you that it's a problem. That's an occupational hazard.
One thing I'd point out, Scott, when you look at that graph, it takes a little interpretation. It looks sort of like an upside down issue. But if you were what's called normal or young ear, that graph would be horizontal in the 0 to 20 dB range. And mm-hmm. and what that means is if you go down to, say, 7,000 or so, that person has to have that tone some 60 dB or so louder just to be heard compared to a young or natural ear. Mm-hmm. So that's the way you look at it. So when it comes to any kind of correction, that's what a audiologist and hearing aid specialist is faced with. I'd also mention that Sensophonics in Chicago also test out to 16 kilohertz routinely, mainly because I deal with a lot of musicians as well.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, so Bob, tell us about the elements of this project that we're talking about here today, and these files that you have created for people to sort of test their own hearing.
Okay. Do you have the graphic that shows things you need?
Number one, required equipment.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. So here on the right, we see the questioning person that wants to know what their perception is. So we decided what we wanted to do was create some files, those shown in the block on the left, that deal with two topics, dynamic range or bit depth, and frequency response or sampling rate. And those signals we define and validate as to what they are. Then you need to be able to put that on some kind of a playback machine so that you can play it at will for yourself. And we're showing an example of a Sony player. That's about a $300 Sony portable player.
That will play back high-resolution audio files, 2496.
That is correct, right? So it can it's known to be able to play back those signals, and you can use a spectrum analyzer, et cetera, and confirm, yes, it does that. Now, there are other things, too, that you could use. Then you need an amplifier, which this was a little special amp I put together to make sure that the amplifier was capable of the bandwidth needed, because we do our test with a amplifier that can produce signals out to 40 kilohertz. We just assume that nobody is going to go out to 40 kilohertz, so it's a little extra coverage, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to take that signal, and you're going to stimulate the test subject by either a speaker or some kind of headphones. And we then had to locate a loudspeaker, in this case a tweeter, that could be verified to cover a frequency range out to 40 kilohertz well, and also validate what it would do. Also, we took a look at a number of different types of headphones to look at their frequency response as well. But keep in mind, we're doing two kinds of tests. There's actually three we'll talk about. One deals with dynamic range, and two deal with bandwidth. And then finally, we get to the person who has their own unique hearing acuity, and they're in some kind of a space which could be very quiet, could be noisy, and so forth, all of which come together to create the final impression. So what we need to make clear is that if you don't have the tools that allow you to do a fair test, then you're testing something else. You could just as well be testing an audio cassette player if you wanted to, because it has its limits. So right. You could put anything you want in there, but we want to make sure that you know of some devices that can do it, and we list those in a video that's on YouTube that I think you'll reference, and something that will eventually be on the AVS forum for people to go to.
Yep, absolutely. In fact, you bring up an interesting point. When we were talking offline, you said, you know, sure, anybody can play these files on any system they want. And certainly there aren't very many inexpensive speakers, for example, that can go out to 40 kilohertz. I mean, that's kind of rare. You have to spend a lot of money for that. You've developed a system that you wouldn't necessarily have to spend a lot of money on, but you can play these on whatever you have, and you're answering the question, Will high-resolution audio music be any benefit to me on the system that I have? Right? So that's a valid question to ask.
Right, and there's one caveat that will come out of this. It's clear we're just looking at two aspects, that dynamic range and bandwidth. We believe there are other elements of high-resolution systems that we're investigating that would be something not related to either of those. We're loosely calling those in-band artifacts. This could be something dealing with the anti-aliasing or anti-imaging filters that might cause sounds to appear in the mid-band or something like that. We're just looking at two elements of the technology.
Right. Dan, why don't you tell us a little bit about, Bob suggested that we talk about the specifics of the judgment techniques. Do you have anything to say about that in terms of describing what it is you're trying to do here?
Well, in essence, what we're trying to do is something that everyone can do at home. There are formal listening tests, procedures that being trained as a psychoacoustician, I'm aware of, but those take a lot more control. They're the type of scientific study you would do to gather formal data from which you could publish papers with, so on and so forth.
That's not your point here. That's not what you're trying
to
do here.
This is not our objective here. Our objective here is to get something, let's say, out of the laboratory where anyone can use these test files and test their own system in their own environment, and you're going to hear a difference. One thing I've noticed in with audiophile grade equipment and I think we're dealing with the law of diminishing returns that we find, you know, in automobiles, you know, everywhere, that it, you know, to get increased performance takes a lot more cost and energy. And mm-hmm. So what I like about the tests that we are created is that what I like to call like a large signal test, or it's going to be easy to hear the differences. We're not really dealing with the law of diminishing returns in our particular samples. Everyone should be able to hear it's like an obvious difference between something that's rolling off. For example, for the bandwidth test, rolling off at 8 kilohertz versus 20 kilohertz. It should be, for most people, that's going to be an obvious difference. And for some people, that's a new phenomena. You can read about it in your magazines, you can read it on the internet, but to actually hear the difference is something that many people haven't had the opportunity to do. And so we just want to, you know, give it to anyone who wants to test their system, and we know for sure they'll be able to hear some difference. And in my experience dealing with audiophile grade equipment, that can be really hard to do sometimes. Bob had alluded to some of the things starting to look at, for example, time smearing from anti-aliasing filters. That's a more subtle effect. And there are other subtle effects, nonlinear subtle effects that you can get in audio equipment, but you really have to listen carefully. You have to be careful with your source signals. You have to control your environment. What we've got and what we're presenting today is something very simple that people can obviously hear a difference, and they'll be able to make their own judgments in a simple manner.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get into those tests deeply and find out exactly what they entail and what's in them and how to use them. But before we do, I'd like to take a moment to thank our first sponsor for this episode, which is the Ring Video Doorbell. Now, we're all familiar with the sound of a doorbell. It means a package is being delivered or friends are coming over for dinner. But it also is the sound of someone planning to rob you. Over 95% of home break-ins happen during the day, and burglars almost always start by ringing your doorbell to see if someone's home before pillaging your possessions. With the Ring Video Doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. Ring's advanced motion detection alerts you even if someone doesn't ring the doorbell. With Ring Video Doorbell, you can talk to delivery people and keep an eye on your package. If someone tries to mess with it, you'll get an instant alert and HD video of the whole thing. It's like having a neighbor keep an eye on your home 24/7. Now, I'm really happy to have the Ring Video Doorbell, and I'll tell you why. I get an email newsletter from my neighborhood, and recently there was a story on the newsletter about a woman who was pilfering packages from stoops from the doorstep of people who weren't home. And there was actually video of it, not from a Ring Video Doorbell, but somebody had snapped a picture of her running away. And so I'm so happy to have the Ring Video Doorbell because I'll know if she shows up at my house. Very, very cool. It's super peace of mind. Now, installing Ring takes minutes, and it works with either your current wiring or a built-in rechargeable battery. So put your mind at ease and protect your home with the Video Doorbell, Time Magazine, and USA Today named one of their top 10 gadgets. Go to ring.com/HTG for free expedited FedEx shipping. That's ring.com/HTG. With Ring, you are always at home. And we thank Ring very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Okay, so we're talking about some new tests, new audiophile tests that, and by that I mean AUDIOFILE, two words, Bob Schuline and Dan Mapes Riordan have created. And we're going to talk about those files now very particularly and specifically to find out exactly what they are and how they work. Bob, why don't you start us off with, say, the dynamic range test, which is, I think, the first one you generally have been talking about.
Yes. Again, we have a graphic that should help, Scott, which, sure. There you go. Okay. So here's the idea. We want you to listen to a short bit of music, which you see in the time graph on the left in that center slide, and you're going to play that as loud as you want or tolerate. That would represent your max level, and that's different for everybody. Then we're going to reduce it in level by a given amount as detailed in that chart on the left, and then after that we're going to repeat it. So you'll not only hear what it sounds like to be, say, 15 dB lower, but you will also be able to determine as you go down and down in attenuation where you can't hear it anymore, which is going to be a function of how loud you played it, your hearing, how you're exciting your ears, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So to take the test, you load this up on your player, and we generally recommend for this earphones, and you sequence through all of these files, and you reach a point where you say, boy, when I drop this thing to this number of dB, I can't hear this. So now you've got this number, X dB. So what this is doing, it's as if the music that you heard, it's played by, in this case, Linda Ronstadt and the Nelson Riddle Orchestra, could turn themselves down on cue, and you would find a point where, gee, I can't hear them anymore. So then you end up with a decibel number, which you then can compare to, let's say, 16-bit words or 24-bit words, what have you.
And, now, the important thing here, I think I should make sure everybody understands, is you have a series of files, separate wave files, uncompressed wave files, and this clip of music is played three times, and each file, the middle clip is reduced by another 5 dB. So you get down 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, all the way down to 90 dB less than the original, the first clip, the first and third clips. And so you play them until you get to the point where you can't hear that middle clip anymore.
That is correct.
And that's your dynamic range. You can tell you have a number.
Right. And that number could even change for an individual. Let's say you would like to know your dynamic range for background music. You're going to set it to a much lower listening level, and you won't have to go down as many dB before you can't find it or hear it anymore.
Right.
Whereas if you're listening at your loudest level, that's when you're going to be most sensitive. And that's a trait that differs between people. The way you play it back is going to make a difference. For example, if you play it through loudspeakers in your listening room and it's not dead quiet, the background noise in the room is going to mask the signal when it drops in level, for example. So we recommend that if you want to get your very best sensitivity, wear a ceiling earphone or insert earphone where the background noise is blocked out and also in a quiet space. And now you're probably going to get the biggest number for you.
Right. Now we have a one example audio file of this particular test. I believe it's down 15 dB. It's called the dynamic range test.
Right. That's correct.
Let's give a listen to that. It's only 40 seconds or so.
For a ride in the air, the monkey thought that everything was on a square.
So this is 15 dB lower than that first clip.
Right.
The buzzer took the monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on a square. Took the monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on a square.
Hey, Scott, I always like to watch people when they listen to this stuff. We can really tell you're a musician because you're really getting into it. Yeah,
I always do.
But you can your eyes open there, and that's cool.
So, thank you. So one quick question, Dan, maybe you can jump in here. I know Bob can answer it too, but why did you do a full level and then a reduced level and then back to full level again?
Well, there's more than one reason to do it. One is it's a nice comparison, especially when you go back. You know, the endpoints are like anchors, and so the actual test signal that you're actually trying to listen to is the one that's attenuated. But so by having going back to reference, they serve as anchors. This way we describe it in the psychoacoustic literature anyways, one way. Another nice thing about it too is it can keep you honest in terms of setting it to your normal listening levels. You can imagine if we just had the regular level followed by the attenuated level, someone could like really turn it up loud during the quiet level and say, oh yeah, I can hear that. But once the normal level came back in, they'd say they would, you know, blow their ears and they would regret that they had done that. So it kind of keeps them honest too, in terms of what your normal listening level is.
Dan, one question I wanted to ask you about the dynamic range test we just heard in particular is there any psychoacoustic phenomenon whereby some sort of accommodation, or you've just been listening to something loud and then you're listening to something much quieter. Is there any kind of precedence effect or persistence of hearing, if you will, to sort of mask that maybe if you hadn't heard that high volume one first, that the low volume one you might be able to hear, but hearing that one first, you can't perceive it? Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I know exactly what you mean, Scott. From a masking standpoint, there really isn't much masking going on because the time durations are much longer than we typically experience masking. It wouldn't be termed masking. The closest thing we could attribute to it, though, would be the issue of loudness changes due to changes in the listening level. In that regards, there is a little bit of an effect. If you play something really loud, our ears have an acoustic reflex effect that kind of clamps down. But again, the time constant of that is such that it recovers fairly quickly. And in the matter of in the tens or, you know, tens or hundreds of milliseconds. So, again, this is too long. The other aspect is this was my master's thesis was on loudness was called loudness recalibration at the time, where you can make sounds be louder or quieter if you played a loud sound before them. Again, the evidence though is that that's only applies to like sine tones and things like that. And so when it comes to complex things like music, again, that's really not going to it's been shown not to have as much of an effect.
Okay. All right. As I was listening to this, as I was preparing for the show, I realized, I wonder if there was such a thing. But you're right. It's probably on the order of milliseconds. And this is a 20-second clip. So your ear will recover quickly and in plenty of time to hear that lower level clip, if you can in fact hear it at all.
That's correct. So for complex signals, this would not be an issue. But just as a side note, I did do, I did research on loudness effects, where we were measuring loudness recoveries in the matters of tens of seconds, if not minutes, where
really?
But they only applied to sine tones. And so that's a lab experiment, not a real world experiment.
So, Bob, why don't you explain to us the first of the two frequency response or bandwidth tests, which involves a high-pass filter.
Great. Again, we've got a graphic, Scott, that you can pull up that's, again, looks rather complicated. But this test is similar in implementation in that you, the listener, select different tracks as shown on the left-hand column and then make a judgment based on each one of those. The signal that you're listening to, which is shown graphically as the blue curve in the center upper, is that of a recording we made of a musical chime. And I think you have a graphic that shows the musical chime recording scheme. There you go. With our laboratory microphone and the Latin percussion chime that was used. So that blue curve represents the spectrum of that chime. So the high-pass filter, which has a very steep slope, is moved up in frequency. And as you listen, you first hear the full bandwidth chime, and then you hear a limited bandwidth chime modified by a high-pass filter. And the files go in 1 kilohertz steps. So your task is to figure out where you can't hear it anymore. And that gives you a stake in the ground that says if the elements of this chime above this frequency are inaudible to me under these conditions. And right. that's the first of the chime test.
Well, let's give a listen to that. Before we go on, just so people can hear sort of what it is we're talking about. This is a much shorter clip because it's only a recording of one swipe across the chimes. And I believe right. in this, I don't remember what, I think was it 5 kilohertz high-pass filter applied to it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, there it is. Let's give a listen to this. So clearly, you could hear the full bandwidth of the chime recording and then the band limited recording, which basically has a high pass filter at 5 kilohertz. So all you're hearing is 5 kilohertz and above, and then back to the full bandwidth again. And they clearly sounded different to me.
Right. That's the idea. I wanted to give one for the presentation today where it was pretty obvious to everybody. Now, Dan can get into our motivation for the second test, which takes into account a concept called masking.
All right, Dan, let's talk about the second test.
Sure. The second test is similar, similar format, but instead of using a high-pass filter, we use a low-pass filter. And you can see the list of filters on the left there. And we're more or less going to sweep the cutoff from 2 kilohertz up to 30 kilohertz, but it's going to be low pass, so it's going to be including more and more of the source signal. And the idea there is to the perception is going to be very different, but what you're going to hear then is like when does it stop? When does it sound just like the reference? Whereas when you have the low pass cutoff at the lower settings, you obviously hear the lack of high frequencies. But as we keep on increasing the cutoff frequency, you'll get to a point where, I don't know if I can hear the difference between the two. And you can then mark the number where you feel like, I can't tell the reference signals on the either ends from the test signal in the center.
Mm-hmm. Let's give a list. Sorry, go ahead, Bob.
No, I should have let you go ahead with the demo.
I just want to hear people hear this again. I think in this case, the low pass filter cutoff is at 5 kilohertz also?
Yeah, sort of like AM radio versus FM radio.
So here's going to be the full bandwidth, and then the band limited, which you'll hear frequencies below 5 kilohertz, and then the full band again. Here we go. So clearly, the second signal is band limited. You don't hear those high frequencies. And the point is, as you step through these files, that cutoff frequency of the low pass filter will increase by 1 kilohertz increments. And at some point, you'll listen to the first one and the second one and the third one, and you'll go, I don't hear any difference between them. And then you'll step up to the next one, and I still don't hear any difference. And the next one, I still don't hear any difference. So that first filter cutoff where you said to yourself, I don't hear any difference, that's your effective high end of your hearing acuity for high frequencies. But this test is a little different, Dan, isn't it? Other than the fact that we're listening to the lower frequencies rather than the higher frequencies, has something to do with masking.
Yeah, that's correct. And so in this case, in the high pass case, you're using less and less energy. You're taking energy away. In this case, you're actually adding energy, and the energy is in the spectral content below the energy of what you would be at the higher frequencies. And so you will get a masking effect in this particular example where what you can hear any differences you can hear might be less perceptible than if you didn't have the source signal present. And so there will be a masking effect here as well, but also there will be the loss of, if you have a high frequency hearing loss, that would show up in this test as well, where if you keep increasing, adding more frequencies, if you don't have, for example, if you have some hair cell damage in the cochlea, then at high frequencies, it may not make any difference to you.
Right, exactly.
Right, and we generally noticed a trend here, Scott, that without exception, of everybody that took the test, they got a higher number for the high pass than they did with the low pass, and they typically differed by 1 to 2 kilohertz. And we think the low pass is more indicative of what real music would be like, because this chime being reproduced with just the high frequency energy, true, it's a chime and it's a real musical instrument, but that's not the way you're probably going to listen to it.
Right. It's going to be in with a bunch of other musical instruments, probably. You're not going to just listen to, you know, concerto for chime and nothing else.
Yes, right.
Okay, good. Well, we've got plenty more to talk about, but before we do, I'd like to take a moment to thank our other sponsor for this episode, which is Drobo. Now, everybody knows that digital data is essential to our lives. Drobo is a safe, simple, and expandable solution for all of your storage needs. Drobo offers a family of external storage arrays. You can either add your own drives or order them preloaded with storage. Drobo's 5N, for example, is perfect for network-attached storage as a media server, file server, or backup solution. It's easy to use. Just plug it into your switch or router, and you're ready to go. Apps let you backup data to 2 different cloud service providers or sync via BitTorrent Sync. It also works well with Plex on the new Apple TV. Now, photographers should check out the Drobo Mini and the Drobo 5D. The Mini is a lightweight and portable, just over 2 pounds, and it has 4 drive bays for up to 8 terabytes of storage. The 5D is a desktop unit with space for 5 3.5-inch drives and a maximum capacity of 64 terabytes. Both have an optional mSATA SSD acceleration bay, which accelerates small file reads. This is especially useful with image library software like Adobe Lightroom or Apple Photos, as well as its predecessors, Aperture and iPhoto. Now, I've got much of my music library on my Drobo at home. And in fact, I just recently added the music of a wonderful artist by the name of Esperanza Spalding. I saw her concert a couple nights ago and immediately had to have that music in my house. So I loaded it onto my Drobo, and it plays beautifully on all of the Sonos devices in my house. Setting it up was super easy. You know, just throw those drives in there and set it up with an app. It was very, very easy to do. Drobos are reliable. Data received by your Drobo and not yet written to disk is protected if there's a sudden power loss. Even better, Drobos have an internal eUSB device where data is copied if there's a power failure to protect against long outages. They're expandable. Add or replace drives in your Drobo with ease. No tools required. It has Beyond RAID technology, which lets you expand on the fly and mix and match drives. I found that really cool to be able to put in drives of different sizes. It's also simple. The colored lights on the front of the Drobo communicate status. And it's fast. It supports Thunderbolt, Gigabit, and USB 3.0 connections. The connection varies per model, so you might want to check on that. Visit Drobo.com/twit to learn more and check out their complete line of products. And when you use the code TWIT100, you'll save $100 off the purchase of a Drobo Mini, Drobo 4-Bay, or Drobo 5N. That's Drobo.com/twit and use the code TWIT100. And we thank Drobo very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Okay, so we've heard these test files, examples of them, and you have to remember that in each case, in all three of these experiments, you'll have a series of files, and they will each step through either more and more attenuation in the case of the dynamic range test, or higher and higher frequencies in the case of the frequency response tests. And you'll be able to tell for yourself where your own limits are and where the limits of your system are. Now, I'd love to talk a minute about the how you might put together a system, even if, say, you don't have a home audio system that can go out to 40 kilohertz. There's a way to do it that isn't really even all that expensive. Bob, why don't you tell us a little bit about the sort of system that you put together to actually perform these tests yourself? And we got a couple pictures here. I want to make sure everybody sees them while you're talking.
So you're going to, some of the stuff you have to buy, of course, is some kind of a player. And, the Pono player is more expensive than the Sony player, but as far as I can tell, either of those would play back the files well. Then I checked out this amplifier from Dayton Audio. Those that are familiar with the company Parts Express could purchase this sort of thing. It's about $88 US, and it's been validated to be able to do the task. The next part.
And what's important there is that the amplifier has a bandwidth. It can actually reproduce an output up to 40 kilohertz.
Right, and low enough distortion, too.
Right.
So then as you see to the right, there's this thing that looks like a piece of sewer pipe, which it actually is, pointing at my ear. And if we go to the slide that has an exploded view of that piece of pipe, there we go. This is the do-it-yourself kit. Again, once you get into the YouTube video or the AVS forum documentation, you'll see that there's a tweeter made by a company called Timpani that we validated as having very nice frequency response to do the tests. That gets put into one end of the tube. It's a closed-back tweeter, so you don't have to worry about filling the tube with anything. The screws go in just to, for decorative purposes. So you put the tweeter in one end, and you put a cap in the other, and then you affix to that a audio jack so that you can feed it audio. And then there's a flange that you can use to attach it to, like a photo tripod. And the cyanoacrylate or crazy glues can be used to hold things together. And then a company in the U.S. called McMaster Carr will sell you all these plastic bits, including those two rubber pieces, which I put on just to protect the assembly when you want to take it around. Then I poke a hole in it so that when you slip it over the tweeter, you don't put a static pressure on the tweeter and do damage. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what you need. And then for listening to the dynamic range test, we recommend some type of insert earphones, which you might have already.
And there are many companies that do that, including, Dan, Edemotic Research, where you also spend some of your time, right?
That's correct. We make many models.
Make many models of insert
earphones. For many
earphones.
Years.
Yeah, and they're very, very high quality. Does Edemotic have... could you use these also for the hearing the frequency response test? Do they actually go up beyond 20 kilohertz, well beyond 20 kilohertz?
We can get output beyond there, but they're really designed for up to 20. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. how they're spec'd.
Yeah, I do have a slide that you may have got in there, Scott, of some real ear measurements I made on one of the Edemotic products and also a circumoral earphone.
Yes, that's number 14. There it is.
Yeah, now there's nothing wrong with doing that. Nothing at all. The technique of measure is explained in more detail in the video presentation. But for, as they call, high face value, we wanted to use a real speaker that we could calibrate where your head was going to be and show what the signals were, and you step in there and you listen. We found that when you listen with headphones, you have to make sure that your headphone amplifier really has the headroom to not get into trouble with the higher frequencies components, and we found some that don't work too well. So we wanted to separate these two. No problem with dynamic range, but the bandwidth test we think works better with a real speaker source.
Mm-hmm. Dan, Free Wi-Fi in the chat room is asking, don't the dynamic range tests just measure the sustained maximum level a person is able to tolerate? How about sounds that last only a fraction of a second, like a pin drop? Can the level be a lot higher?
If your goal is to listen to the anchor settings to see how loud they can be, yeah, certainly. And yes, you could tolerate higher levels if they're shorter duration. That there is somewhat of an equal energy concept where the shorter duration, the higher the amplitude can be for about the same loudness. It's mm-hmm. not exact relationship, but it's in generally true.
Mm-hmm. But of course, we don't, you know, listening to music is not a momentary event. It's a long-term event. And so I think the test you guys have set up is more appropriate for that as well. Let's see. Creamy Corn Cob in the chat room is asking about the Pono player in particular. And Bob, you've measured it. You've measured the output of the DAC within the player, and the bandwidth of the headphone or audio output is perfectly sufficient for what we're doing here, right?
Absolutely. The test that I did on the players was to make a file in which we recorded some pink noise at, this is using the Audacity editing program, mm-hmm. Where you record it at maximum CD level. So that has a average level that's maybe some 12 dB or so below peak level. That's the loudest. And then you record digital zero. Now you play that back on the player of choice. Now this isn't a file that's in there. And you get some idea of what the dynamic range capability is of the player that you have. And your hope is that it's able to allow you to encompass the full 90 dB tests. Now, this is going to differ from player to player. But we found we got essentially the same results in terms of potential dynamic range with this Tascam recorder we used, the Sony machine. Yeah, there you go. And the Pono player. Here would be a good spot to make an observation. When you're in the digital, I'm sorry.
I say, please go on.
Oh, okay, great. So when you're in the digital world, you can't hear anything, obviously, but you can do all kinds of manipulations. To find out what you really have, you have to go back into the analog world and listen. So the analog world in a DAC is going to be the analog portion of the DAC, and it's going to have a certain signal-to-noise ratio capability. So it may be quite the case that your digital file exceeds the analog capability of that DAC, and you don't see the true dynamics of the digital signal. So that's why you have to be aware of that when you do some of these listening tests. So practically speaking, we found that at least three devices could get you down 85 dB with not much trouble.
So looking at this graph right here, we're looking at pink noise at
right.
different levels, 0 right. dB, 5, minus 5, minus 10, and so on. When you get down to minus 85, minus 90, they're starting to not be 5 dB apart.
Right, because the self-noise of the player interferes with the actual signal. Mm-hmm. And this observation is not common knowledge for people that don't mess with this stuff. My practical comment is these things are way good enough for any kind of music you want to listen to. But if you're sort of go by the numbers, you might say, gee, I think I want something better. I looked, for example, online to a very high-performance DAC made by a company called Percotzi, and their signal-to-noise ratio for their DAC was at 120 dB A-weighted, and I believe that would be a pure tone, say a kilohertz, as the reference level, and A-weighted noise as the bottom limit. But when you're using program material, everything isn't at the max level, except
right.
some music we know about. But
yeah, right.
real music that sounds good to people has an average value, maybe 12 dB or so below peak value. And if you're making a digital file, it's the peak value that you want to keep in line with your system so that doesn't overload.
Mm-hmm. User 9920 in the chat room is asking, what about using a PC as a source device? Can you just use a PC? And he has Bose Companion 5 multimedia speakers. I doubt those go out to 40 kilohertz. I think using a PC as a source device, as long as it has a sound card that can deal with 2496 files, shouldn't be a problem, right?
Right. Here's where you have to experiment. And there are many PC systems where you can use an outboard DAC. And and these DACs are not that expensive, you know, $100, $150. So mm-hmm. that you very much can be assured that analog output would be just dandy for what you want to do.
Right.
And the speakers, of course, are a different case. You either have to have some reliable measurements or, as we're doing, believe that we found something that works well and trust our data and trust the data from the manufacturer. But that tweeter is only about $25.
Right. And then some PVC piping and some crazy glue, and you put it together and you have
right.
a test system that would work really well.
Correct.
Well, in the few minutes we have left, two more things to cover real quick. One is the results of the AES testing. You did some testing at the Chicago chapter of the AES Audio Engineering Society, and also at the national conference last November, I believe. And Dan, we have one graphic of that, graphic number 15, I believe. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's our summary. Dan, unfortunately, was not at these two meetings. So
I'll let Bob talk about it.
Reporting. Now, I will tell you that all of this data was what I call self-reported. we asked the people to take the test and give us answers. This was not a blind test and that sort of thing. And I'd say we probably tested probably about 30 people in these two environments. And
these are audio engineers, so they should have pretty they should be very sensitive to audio stimuli.
Right. And I've also taken full advantage of my family, including my 9-year-old grandson.
Oh, very good.
He had the most fun with the dynamic range test because it was like a game. He kept saying, "I can still hear it. I can still hear it." And anyway, so these are the approximate numbers we got. And we're saying that we haven't found anybody that with the high pass tests that went beyond 20 kilohertz and the more realistic bandwidth test 3 about 18. That's not to say that there isn't somebody like that. And if there is, good for them. They have a gift.
Your 9-year-old grandson probably could hear out to 20K.
Yeah, he had a little more trouble articulating the test data for me, but he did okay.
Mm-hmm. And as you saw in the data also, the low-pass test, the average was a little bit lower than the high-pass test, as you mentioned earlier.
All right, due to masking.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Well, Dan, let me ask you then for my last question. So you've tested frequency response or bandwidth. You've tested dynamic range, which are the two sort of most obvious aspects of high dynamic range, of high resolution audio, I should say. And it seems to be a fairly foregone conclusion based on these results that people aren't really going to hear out past 20K, and they're not really going to be able to detect a dynamic range more than about 85 dB, all of which are within CD specs. So you mentioned at the beginning of the show that there might be some other things to investigate. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I'm not the one who's done the research myself. This is something Bob and I are looking into. But
right. Future research.
Yes, for something we want to look at is something other people have been concerned about for many years, and that is that, for example, in A to D converters and D to A converters, you need a low-pass filter as part of their operation, and the sharpness of that filter in the frequency domain has a duality in the time domain that it requires a longer time response. That time response can create what has been known to be called as a time smearing of the source signal when it gets applied to your music material. Some people claim that you can, in certain circumstances, hear this time smearing. And it's related to the lengths of the filters, which are, you can say, inversely related to the slope of the low-pass filter in the A to D and D to A. And so that's a place where we want to look closer. And other people, Bob Stewart had AES convention paper, I believe it was in 2014, describing a system where he's optimized the slope with the time resolution to, he thinks, got an optimum solution. But that's an example, and I think this is an example that is helped. The reason why we have oversampling converters is that if we can sample at a higher rate and then use a more gentle slope for the low-pass filter in order to get the same, noise performance, but we don't require a sharp, what we'd call a brick wall filter. If we were just sampling at the 44.1 kilohertz, we would have to, and we want to go at the 20 kilohertz, we got to have a sharp filter between 20 kilohertz and 22.050 hertz. And so That's a case where oversampling can result in a gentler slope filter, which would have a better and shorter time response.
Now, I have a question about that. I have a question about that, which is that in the low-pass filter and the high-pass filter tests that we've been talking about, That's the slope of that filter is brick wall. It's 192 dB per octave. Were you concerned about any kind of these artifacts might intrude into the audio files that you're presenting here?
Indeed, there indeed could be some time smearing. We don't really hear any, but if people point it out, they're welcome to. I believe some source signals are more relevant for exposing smearing than others. Perhaps maybe the chimes just don't give you that effect. Yes, that could possibly be in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, in the case of the chime, we were also concerned about probably the most logical culprit, which would be the speaker. And the artifact that the speaker could create would be intermodulation distortion that would fold down into the audio band. So mm-hmm. by measurement, we tried to get what we thought was the best. And then when we tested people, we were keen on discovering, as you went up and up in frequency, do you hear something that doesn't sound like a chime, you know, a grungy noise or something like that? And we essentially got none of that. A few people said that once they got up to higher frequencies, they heard something that didn't sound like a chime. And we're also curious that this could be a distortion issue with your hearing system, because your hearing system isn't perfectly distortion free. Mm-hmm. So we would say that the elements of in-band artifacts didn't really get in the way of these tests because they were so sort of black and white, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But that's the subject we want to look at. I've had some anecdotal evidence shown to me by one company that makes a professional DAC in which they have different types of filters, some being linear phase, some being minimal phase. And the gentleman that demonstrated it to me said, now here is an example of what I think is an artifact that a linear phase filter creates. And I listened. And then here's minimum phase. And I was able to pick out I wouldn't call it a grunge, but an additional sound to something that was clearly in the audio band. So this is interesting to us that we'd like to try to find these things out so that we could say for the standard CD and processing, what could you do to minimize these things if you wanted to?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other thing.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The other thing I wanted to say is we're not damning high resolution audio with a broad stroke. We do production ourselves, and we record in 2496, but we're doing editing and things of that nature. So when you're at that part of the production, you want this a dynamic range, in particular, capability, because as you are doing any kind of signal processing and so forth, you want that full capability. But once you're all done and you're ready to export it to the consumer, that's the point in which we were focusing.
Mm-hmm. One last thing from SoundPro 69 in the chat room. We're running a little over here, but it's really fascinating, so I want to get this in. SoundPro 69 says, what about the argument that supersonic frequencies, when present, ultrasonic really, might interfere with lower frequencies and create additional sounds in the audible frequency range? And I would extend that to say, what about what are called difference tones, where you might have two ultrasonic frequencies that interfere with each other in a way that produce what are called in-band products or subtractions, basically. So that might argue for having frequencies above 20 kilohertz, even if you can't hear them directly. This might be another source of in-band artifacts. Dan, what do you think?
It's conceivable that if you had if we think of the chime example and you have the mixing of some of those higher overtones, could they produce some beating against each other in some mm-hmm. manner to go back to the bass band? It's conceivable, but I think this is another case where we're back to the law of diminishing returns. anything that gets produced there probably isn't like the predominant sound you're going to be hearing. It's going to be a subtlety. And if it's a subtlety that becomes obvious, then it would really have a lot of merit. If it's something that is really hard to produce, then perhaps, people have to make their own judgments of how much effort they want to do or how much equipment they want to get to produce that subtle effect.
Right, exactly. Well, listen, it's been a fascinating discussion. We've run out of time and then some, but I want to thank you both for being here so much. I want to also say that in the next day or two, I will have these test files posted on avsforum.com along with some explanatory material, and people will be able to download them and try this out for themselves, either on their own system with their own earbuds or headphones, or even by building that little Franken speaker that Bob Schuline put together, because it definitely has the capability of reproducing up to 40 kilohertz. So you can really test your high frequency acuity using that sort of thing. So look for that in the next couple of days on AVS. And in the meantime, let me thank Bob Schuline for being here. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Scott. I appreciate what you've done to allow us this opportunity and what you're going to do in AES Forum that helps get the word out. So thank you.
I'm always happy to do that, especially getting people involved in their own systems and their own experience. And Dan Mapes-Riordan, thank you so much for being here. I hope to have you back again.
All right. Thanks, Scott. I appreciate being invited, and anytime.
You bet. Thank you. You can find me, of course, first I should say that both Dan and Bob can be found at immersive.com. That's immersav.com. You can find me always, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be headphone maven Tyle Hertzens. And he asked me, I asked him to be on the show again, and he said, can we do a chat room Q&A? Because I'd love to answer questions from the chat room. So if you guys have questions about headphones, cue them up, get them ready to go. Next Thursday, we will be answering questions and getting geeky over headphones. So I do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.